Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. It is Thursday the 9th, and I should have had a podcast going out to you guys today. It'll go out tomorrow, I think. I've been, slacking. It's probably the best excuse I could come up with. Got a good one recorded yesterday, though, with Scott and Nick White, so that one will come out after this one, fun conversation with them, talking about elk hunting and other stuff. So you got a good one coming up following this one. Good news since the last time I talked to you guys, I got my Nevada mule deer tag. Woohoo! Man, I'm fired up. I'll tell you what, this gives me a really good season. Got a Nevada mule deer, a Colorado mule deer, and a Colorado elk hunt now. Got everything all lined up for camera guys. Tim Nebel is going to be coming along to film for me in Nevada. That'll be his first time to Nevada. He's excited about it. He's been on that Under Armour challenge there with me and Ben Massey and Dan from Vancouver Island Backcountry is on there with us as well. Let me scroll through here. I got my friend list all cluttered up here because I joined the challenge that my stepsons have been doing out there in NorCal, and there's a bunch of people on there as well. So it kind of mixes everybody in. Unfortunately, I'm not smart enough, or I'm not sure if there's a way to break up the group there. But Blaine Hostetler, I see you guys are on here. I think I already said Ben Massey, and I see that Ben has been dying in the heat out there. Poor guy. Ben's going to be filming for me in Colorado for mule deer. And one thing that you can look forward to, Ben, is it's not going to be 100 degrees up there or anywhere near approaching that. So I've been doing my runs first thing in the morning, and it's actually a little chilly. So that makes it a hell of a lot easier. I don't know what the temperature is, but I would say it's got to be in the low 60s or something. I'll have to make note of that when I'm driving up to the trailhead, and then I can report back on that, because Ben's been doing it in feel like 100 degree weather. And Tim hasn't complained about the weather that I see yet, but I'm sure he's suffering as well. He's been doing a lot of hiking with a heavy pack, and I need to start doing that as well. I'm trying to just work right now on cardio, and then definitely cooking my legs, though. They're feeling it. But hey, I won't make the whole podcast about how tired my legs are and how it feels like I've got lung burn. But I am making progress. I've shaved about 4 minutes off of my time, which is more than 10% off of my my run time. So I'm pretty pleased about that. It's good to see forward progress. We are going to do a Patrick McManus this morning, and it is called Mean Tense. I once shot 3 arrows through my cousin Buck's brand new wall tent. This may not seem remarkable to you, but it was to Buck. I can still recall several of his remarks, in fact, even though at the time they were made, I was vaulting a high board fence as he tried to tear off one of my legs. It happened like this. I was out in Buck's backyard practicing with his bow and arrows when he showed up carrying a large bundle of canvas on his shoulder. Buck was 4 years older than I, or about 20. He had a job and could afford to buy all kinds of neat hunting and fishing stuff. I could use the stuff anytime I wanted, provided Buck wasn't around. His mother, my Aunt Sophie, who thought highly of me, was always eager to help the less fortunate, who in this case happened to be me. She would unlock the door to Buck's bedroom and even help me disarm some of the booby traps her ingenious son had set to maim or kill me, should I sneak in to use his stuff. "What are you doing with my bow?" Buck snarled, even though it was perfectly obvious I was target practicing. Pretending not to hear, I said, "Gosh, Buck, what's that you got there?" Instantly, his mood flip-flopped. "A new wall tent," he exclaimed. "I just bought it. Wait till you see this baby. I'm going to take it up into the mountains next fall and set up a hunting camp like you wouldn't believe. I got this little wood stove I'm going to put in it for heat, and a little table and chairs and a couple of cots." Having distracted him from uncharitable thoughts about my use of his bow, I helped him drag the tent across the backyard to a flat area about 10 feet from the bale of the hay I'd been using as a target. We soon had the tent pitched, its canvas taut and gleaming in the sun. I had to admit, it was a nice-looking tent. Buck thought it was beautiful. We had to step back to admire it. Well, he was in such a good mood, I said, "Yeah, that's a terrific tent, Buck. Mind if I shoot a few more arrows?" "What? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Now, you see this canvas? It's special canvas. This canvas is windproof and..." I casually let fly with an arrow at the target. The arrow curved like a boomerang in flight and with a tiny zip through the roof of the tent. "What? Waterproof?" Buck's eyes widened. His jaw gaped slowly as if held by a weak spring. "It was an accident, Buck," I cried, snatching up another arrow. "Your arrow must have been crooked. See, I shot it just like this." The second arrow zipped through the tent. I could not believe this was happening. It was as if the tent had a magic attraction for arrows. I glanced at Buck. He seemed okay, except for the possible paralysis of his entire nervous system. His lips made a little jerking motion, but otherwise he was immobile. "I can explain, Buck. Some of these arrows are crooked. They curve when you shoot. Now this arrow is straight. Watch, it'll hit the target. Those other two arrows were crooked. It's not my fault. You have crooked arrows. Here goes." It was the strangest occurrence I had ever encountered. Having considerable interest in science, I would have liked to have studied how not one, not two, but three arrows could be drawn 10 feet off course and through the roof of a tent. By this time, however, Buck had come unthawed and unwrapped, cutting short any hopes I might have had for discovering the attraction of tent canvas for arrows. I took my usual escape route over the back fence, sacrificing only half a pant leg to the clawing hands of my crazed cousin. 30 years later, Buck would still be convinced that I had deliberately shot the arrows through the tent for no better reason than to aggravate him, but I was innocent. The guilty party was the tent itself, its motive nothing more than to cause me trouble. In fact, tents have always had it in for me. Remember the old inferior frame umbrella tent, the one with a contraption called the spider that was supposed to hold everything together? We used one of these tents for 15 years. Every camping family in America owned one. Few people know, however, that they were originally developed by research psychologists as a stress test to determine the limits of sanity. Later, the U.S. Army got a hold of the IFUT, as the interior frame umbrella tent was known, and experimented with it as a means of training recruits in hand-to-hand combat. When it was rejected by the Army as too demoralizing to the troops, tent manufacturers decided the IFUT was perfect for campers. After all, they reasoned, campers go out seeking hardship and adventure. Pitching the IFUT would provide the average camper with about all the hardships and adventures he could stand. Even though we had last used our IFUT more than 10 years ago, before we moved up to the exterior frame tent, I can still recall vividly the typical routine of pitching it. I had just staked down the floor of the tent. The tent came with plastic tough stakes, which would greatly ease this task, but of course all the stakes had now been lost. I have substituted crooked pieces of tree branch for the plastic stakes, pounding them in with a flat rock. This results in my having to perform the crouch hop, a primitive dance in which the performer holds one hand between his thighs and hops about chanting "aye, aye, aye," and other chants while his wife holds her hands over her ears of the youngest child. Now comes the dreaded part. I must crawl into the shapeless mass of canvas to insert the interior frame. Powdery remains of last year's insects come sprinkling down upon my face. The tiny, stickery legs are the worst part, particularly when they go down the back of your shirt collar. I sneeze. A cause of sneezing, powdered bug is just about as bad as pepper. Some people think it's a whole lot worse. Squeamish people almost always abandon camping during this phase of pitching the IFUT. Not all the bugs are dead. At least one daddy longlegs will have survived the winter for the sole purpose of racing up your pant leg. When you're standing in the dark with a collapsed tent around your head, a daddy longlegs racing for your vitals feels as big as a Dungeness crab. The part of the frame called the spider has four arms, each of which extends out to a corner of the roof tent. The upright poles, in theory at least, insert into the outer edges of the spider arms. A short, sharp edge pipe protrudes downward from the center of the spider. The sharp end of this pole pipe is placed on the top of your head to hold the spider in place while you attach the poles. This explains why all old-time campers have a series of little overlapping circles on the tops of their heads. I am now standing in the tent with one spider charging up my leg and the other spider cutting donut holes in my scalp. Quickly, I insert the first pole into the spider, but it won't stay in place by itself until another pole has taken the slack of the tent. I balance on one leg and hold the pole up with the other. Quick, I yell to my little helpers outside, hand Daddy another pole. I immediately hear the sound of scurrying feet, followed by heated arguments. I got it first. Lego. Ah, I say, Dad, just get Daddy the pole. Daddy wants me to do it. Give it here. Ah, I say, hurry. Ah, give me that pole. Ack, I say, I got it. Here I come, Daddy. I can hear little feet charging through the door of the tent. Easy, easy, I yell, but too late. The pole comes through the flap of the tent like a spear thrust. I think, my wife says later, if we had just one more kid, you could stand one in each corner of the tent to hold a pole while you hook up the spider. That possibility has just been rendered academic, I say. Maybe we'll buy a camper. I still have our old IFUT out in the corner of the garage, and it's surprisingly good shape. My wife says I should donate to the Salvation Army so it can be passed on to a needy family. I point out to her that needy families already have enough problems without inflicting an IFUT on them. Besides, I like to keep the IFUT around for old time's sake. Whenever I get depressed, I could go out and kick it hard several times. Immediately, I feel better. My first tent was a teepee. I made it out of three crooked branches and a blanket when I was about 6 years old. It served me well for an hour or two until I decided to take the chill out of the air by building a fire in it. Presently, my father came wandering out of the house and saw me standing by my teepee, which was putting up little puffs of smoke. It is a traumatic experience, let me tell you, for a small child to see his father. His father stomp out his teepee. Oh my goodness. To complicate matters, Dad never understood what it was to be what it to complicate matters, Dad never understood what it was he had stomped out. He thought I just liked to set fires to blankets. Speaking of strained relations between father and son, I'm reminded of the time a couple of years later when Crazy Eddie Molden and I made a tent out of gunny sacks. We had found the gunny sacks in the back of the Molden barn. Although they were moldy and half rotten and flecked with dried cow manure, Eddie said they would still make a good tent. We obtained a large pair of shears and a curved sacking needle from his father's tool box, which Mr. Molden had thoughtfully left within our reach. By supper time, the tent was finished. I tried to conceal my disappointment over the appearance of the finished product. To me, it looked more like a large, shaggy cocoon than a tent. Crazy Eddie, however, was delighted with it, as he is with all his creations. "We'll set it up in the backyard and sleep in it tonight," he announced. "Okay," I said. Eddie and I had been trying to sleep out all nights in the backyard for most of the summer, but our efforts had always been thwarted by the elements, torrential darkness being the most frequent. So far, our best time had been 9:30, but Eddie had recently discovered a secret weapon, his father's powerful 6-battery flashlight. Furthermore, his father was away on a trip and not expected to be back until late that night. We would simply leave the flashlight on all night and return it to his father's shop in the morning before he was awake and hovering about, eyeing us with suspicion. Mr. Molden would never know the difference. It would teach him a good lesson, too, for gahoffing and teasing us about our failures and at sleeping out past 9:30, even though we gave him detailed reports on the large, weird creatures we had seen prowling the yard. The disaster resulting from this innocent plan cannot be properly understood without knowing the exact sequence of events, which is as follows. 7:30 p.m. Crazy Eddie and I haul a quilt, a blanket, and 2 pillows out to our tent and make our bed. 8 p.m. We crawl under the quilt and lie there looking at the stars through the roof of our tent. We have routinely checked the laces on our tennis shoes for tightness. Kids we know have thrown a shoe coming out of their starting blocks on their way into the house on a dark night. The loss of traction on one side has caused them to waste precious seconds running in a circle. 9 p.m. The condition known as pitch dark has been achieved. Crazy Eddie flips on the powerful light. The beam shoots out through our tent and illuminates the countryside for 100 yards. It seems adequate. Eddie and I exchange smiles of confidence. 10 p.m. Mrs. Molden turns off the house lights and goes to bed. Only the feeble porch light remains on. A sense of apprehension fills the gunny sack tent. The beam of the flashlight has weakened. 10:15 p.m. Mr. Molden gets in his car and begins the long drive home. He turns on the radio to listen to country western music. 11 p.m. The power of the flashlight has diminished to that of a firefly. The porch light provides some illumination. A dark shadow passes over the tent. Eddie and I dig starting blocks with the heels of our tennis shoes through the floor of the tent. 11:05 p.m. Mr. Molden flicks the radio dial to the creaking door. Tonight's program is about a mummy that tracks down and takes revenge on an archaeologist for disturbing its tomb. Mr. Molden shudders at the dry, rustling sounds of the mummy's loose wrappings as they drag across the floor. The mummy says, "Rrr, rrr," which may not be all that articulate, but is pretty good for a mummy. 11:25 p.m. Mr. Molden pulls into his driveway. On the radio, the archaeologist is screaming, "No, no, stay away from me!" Then there's the sound of rappings, scrapings across the floor. "Urr, urr," says the mummy. "Urr." Mr. Molden shuts off the radio, gets out of the car, and heads for the house. Then he goes back and shuts off the car lights. The wind rustles in the bushes. Mr. Molden rushes into the house and turns on the lights. Eddie and I have heard Mr. Molden drive in. Our flashlight is dead. Our tennis shoes are dug into the starting blocks. But now we must wait for Mr. Molden to go to bed. Otherwise, he will tease us unmercifully. Outside, there is a strange rustling sound coming closer and closer. It's a good thing we haven't heard the mummy program. 11:35 p.m. Mr. Molden shuts off the kitchen light and the porch light. He has no good reason to expect his son and me to be outside after 9:30. He goes into the bathroom to take a shower, still thinking about the mummy. 11:45 p.m. The rustling around the tent has increased. Eddie is fumbling with knots on the door but can't untie them in the dark. In a few minutes, Mr. Molden will be in bed asleep. 11:46 p.m. Eddie's dog, Oscar, returns from a date at the neighboring farm and slumps down exhausted on the porch. Oscar has no reason to expect Eddie and I to be outside after 9:30. 11:50 p.m., Mr. Molden thinks he detects a sore throat coming on. He walks into the darkened kitchen, pours some salt into a glass of hot water, and begins to gargle. He is wearing... only towel wrapped around his middle. 11:50 and 30 seconds p.m. Eddie groans. I can't get these dang knots untied in the dark. Let's go inside. We can take the tent off in there. A shadow passes over the tent, accompanied by a sound rustling sound to our rear. We shove our feet through the burlap floor and, hugging the tent around us, hit the starting blocks. 11:50 and 31 seconds p.m. on the porch. Oscar. Oh my goodness. Oscar opens his bleary eyes. A large amorphous shape is charging him, almost on top of him, probably going to eat him. He tries to bark, but is momentarily swallowed in his tongue. He growls. 11:50 and 32 seconds p.m. Eddie and I crash through the door into the kitchen. Instantly, we hear a horrible sound. We don't know what it is. Never before having heard a naked man surprised in mid-gargle by a gunny sack tent. Oscar follows us into the house, still trying to bark. Water splashes on the floor, and there's the sound of naked feet frantically trying to get traction on slippery linoleum. Gargle, 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 cries Mr. Molden. Stay back. Gargle away. Choke from me. We didn't get the mess all sorted out and reconstructed until the next morning. Mr. Molden seemed quite embarrassed by the whole episode and never again teased us for abandoning a backyard camp in the middle of the night. Later, though, he enjoyed recalling the episode of the gunny sack tent and having a good laugh over it. I was away at college by then, however, and never got to hear him. Oh my goodness, that was a doozy. I literally have tears streaming down my face. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that one. That was from the grasshopper trap. Man, McManus hit a grand slam on that one. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I look forward to the next one.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support. I come down